Hello, this is Jeff Treisman.
This is Matt Schmidt.
And you're listening to In Politic.
The book Gender Queer was in our school libraries. Had Moms for Liberty not brought that book to your attention, it might still be there.
I do not want my children to learn about anal sex in middle school.
So I'm calling for the immediate removal of this very graphic, pornographic material from our libraries and our schools.
Do you agree with this book that is being taught with kids that babies are racist?
This is pornography, plain and simple, and it does not belong in our schools.
I'm sure we've got hundreds of people out there that would like to see those books before we burn them.
Our guest today is John Kraska, founder and executive director of the Every Library Institute. He is a former partner and associate director, a Chicago-based consultancy focused on supporting associations and membership recruitment, conference, and governance activities. He is a former president and member of the Board of Trustees for the Berwyn Public Library and is a former president of the Reaching Across Illinois Library System. He's also a director, was a director for membership development at the American Library Association. So with that, John, welcome to In Politic.
It is so nice to be here, guys. Thank you for this opportunity.
The first question, John, is why don't you just explain what Every Library is? Why don't you explain your work and what got you into it?
So Every Library is the only national political action committee for libraries. It's a C4. C4s technically under the IRS code are dark money super PACs. We are nefarious special interests for our dark money super PAC for libraries is, you know, library funding, the authority of libraries to work in the
world.
You
guys you're sponsored by Big Library.
Big Library. Well, actually, our donor base is a little bit of Big Library. It's some publishers. It's the vendor community. Also, small donors. We have kind of a Bernie Sanders model. A lot of humans around the country who think that maybe libraries should stay open, that the First Amendment should be supported, that the 14th Amendment should probably be put to work as well in terms of civil rights, you know. The right to read. The C4 side has been around now for 12 years. We do ballot measures for local libraries, including a couple of the havens around you guys. I mean, it's not just New Haven, it's the Wests and the Easts and all those. We're active in 36 states on library referendum, parcel taxes, warrant articles, millages, mill levies. It's the funding formula when voter approval has to happen. Over the 12 years, we've had 133 election days. We win about 85% of the time. I just passed a building bond in Florida on the Republican presidential primary. Like, we're doing all right with that.
Wow, congrats on that. Yeah.
Thank you. That work is extended into a portfolio around school libraries. We have a portfolio that supports state library associations and their legislative initiatives. And it's turned into, over the last couple of years, with all the censorship and book bans and anti-library legislation, it's a lot of block and tackle right now. We've had more vote no campaigns where we're trying to keep the library open, bad idea, vote it down, than not recently. And the legislative work, while we've been supporting new ideas around the right to read, around libraries for all, most of it's trying to block, defeat, kill, bills that would criminalize librarianship, that would criminalize the collection. So in addition to the C4 side, we have our Every Library Institute, which Jeff mentioned at the beginning. That's our nonprofit. That's public policy, tax policy, education policy. It's your traditional C3 think tank kind of approach, though we are sometimes more tank than think. What we try and do with that is, move our way through some of the big ideas. The structure of libraries in the United States has remained fairly stable. But that also means unchanged for really the last generation or two. We're trying to explore ways to bring in new funding based on different opportunities, both at the federal and state level. Libraries are a creature, not just the First Amendment with the right to read and the 10th Amendment with the right to access. Libraries aren't just a creature of the First Amendment with the right to read or the 14th Amendment with the right to access. They're really 10th Amendment organisms. It's how the states choose to build, how do they choose to tax, how do they choose to organize. So we're really leaning in from that public policy side on that.
And then can I ask you a question? I'm sorry, I want to interrupt here because I think this is really fascinating, and I'm not sure listeners quite understand or that I understand really how my local public library is funded, right? So there's tax money that comes in, but they also raise money, right? How does that work? Are they like magnet schools that in that way? What percentage is generally publicly funded?
Nationally, public library funding comes from the local zip code tax base around 90 to 92%, you know, 93%. The local tax base is either going to a unit of government, like an independent library district, a special district that has the ability to tax directly. So those voter approved measures we're talking about, or it's part of a municipality. So it's a department within a city, a county, a township, a town, a borough, wherever, or it is a nonprofit corporation that's operating under contract with a municipality. And that still is municipal tax funding. Now, nationally, to say 90 to 93%, really, I mean, it's all over the place. In Connecticut, the percentage of locally raised donor money is a lot higher. And you guys are sitting on endowments. You know, your libraries are a lot older than they are in Wyoming, for example, you know. So the endowment space and the fundraising space is a little bit different. If you're in Illinois, where I am, it's a combination of just districts with a little bit of fundraising. You know, some of them are more effective than others, but most of them are just run on tax money. Or municipalities where you've got a friends group that might do a book sale or a bake sale. But really, we're talking about taxpayer-funded institutions. And all of those issues that go into the zip code lottery around K-12. When people talk about, you know, where you're born with your zip code determines your educational outcomes, your health outcomes. It also determines your literacy outcomes with libraries. The funding formula is purely Jeffersonian. And there's some problems with that.
So you had talked or you mentioned about criminalization of libraries and librarians. Let's build on that because that's obviously the topic of discussion for today. Can you, in very broad brush strokes here, tell us what is actually happening now in the United States? What are you seeing? What are we seeing occur in libraries and civic organizations and parent groups in the United States today?
Sure. So the cadence and intensity of attempts to ban or censor materials in public libraries and school libraries, and now starting to encroach in the higher ed space as well, is unprecedented. Penn America, our colleagues over there, have looked at K-12 very, very deeply. We spend a lot of time in public libraries, and between the two of us, it's thousands and thousands of titles. The work that Penn America has done on analyzing K-12, the work that we've been doing on public libraries, it's thousands and thousands of titles. It's dozens and dozens and dozens of places in multiple states. I mean, the Cartesian product on censorship right now is pretty high. It's coming from a couple of different vectors at the same time. What we have seen in the past, it might be an anti-access movement. It might be a moral campaign on the part of a special interest group. It might be, over the years, we've seen some hysteria around sex ed and teaching of gender studies. We, of course, in America, have had a history of racism and bigotry that drives the access conversation, the censorship conversation. And in 2022, in 2023, in 2024, they're all happening at the same time. And then you add an overlay of anti-tax organizations that are really looking at deconstructing, you know, any part of government. So libraries are a soft target. You had an overlay on privatization and public library spaces. You have an overlay on anti-education that's not just about education, but it's also like privatization of education, the vouchers, the charter schools. I mean, it's a perfect storm right now. And the perfect storm elements here are coming together. I mean, the attacks on the collection in some places are proxy fights against LGBTQ community. They're proxy fights against Black and Brown communities. They're proxy fights against public sector workers and around the structure of education. What we're doing, and then that's local level. At the state level, we're seeing a movement that, of course, has anti-gay, anti-trans in it. That is alongside book ban legislation that would go after gay and trans. We're seeing anti-CRT legislation in higher ed. You see book ban legislation that's targeting Black and Brown communities. You see a movement to do vouchers or privatization, either in schools or in public settings. And you have anti-library board, anti-library structure laws come through. And then overlaying it all is the criminalization Right now, criminalization bills have been introduced in almost 20 states, and they've advanced pretty far in several states, including passing and being signed into law in Indiana and in Arkansas. The criminalization.
Give us an example of that. Yeah. Give us an example of the worst.
So the worst is probably the Arkansas one, not to suggest the Indiana one isn't just as bad, but it covers more sectors in Arkansas. And I got to tell you from the beginning, spoiler alert, it's been challenged in court and it's currently being stayed. And it's going through the courts right now. The criminalization provision means that in a place like Arkansas or Indiana or these other 18 states, there's an attempt by the legislature to remove a historic defense from prosecution exemption under obscenity laws. Since the early 1960s, back when we used to write law rather than just doing talking points and politicization, there's been an exemption under obscenity law for bona fide institutions, universities, schools, public libraries, museums. You know, like if we could drag people into you know, if a county prosecutor could come after a museum about naked pictures of people, I mean, but that's part of the moral approach that happens every generation or two. I mean, the Ed Meese years in the Reagan administration, for goodness sake.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah. So the defense from prosecution exemption is not that we are pornographers in libraries. There is no pornography in libraries. Mainstream publishers do not produce it. Education publishers don't produce it. You know, it's not collected. And yet going after the exemption is under the guise of, you know, protecting children, under the guise of, it's really an attack on the structure of government. It's the attack on the public sector workforce and educators. If you are potentially as an educator, as a school librarian, going to be dragged into court or being accused of peddling obscenity for a book on your shelves, you know, for a book in your sex ed class, for a book that you're using in your art history class, that weaponization of the criminal code has to be confronted. In Arkansas,
is this like the American Taliban? This kind of approach, right? Go right for the books, go right for the ideas. Right?
That's an interesting analogy, Matthew.
Well, the core of it, as I said before, it's got a couple of different vectors, but books are always a proxy fight. Books are easier to go after than it is to go after a population. You can say that book about queer people is obscene because it's about queer people rather than attacking, you know, just our neighbors. You know, Americans are becoming more and more tolerant, but they're still perfectly okay with going after a proxy. You know, like that book about race makes somebody uncomfortable. I'm fine with it. I have black friends, you know, but that book about race makes somebody uncomfortable. So we're going to take it out. We know from the polling, the work that we've done, and the survey work that we've done, we did a big thing with Book Riot, you know, the media company that does some extraordinary things around the culture of reading, but also they've got a great censorship beat over there. Kelly Jensen's doing some wonderful original reporting. We did a survey of American parents back in the fall, just parents, because of the Moms for Liberty types that all say that they have the mantle of parent responsibility, parent concern. We were like, really? You do? Let's ask parents, actually, you know. What we found is that, you know, 80-85% of parents and guardians come back and say libraries are very important. Librarians are well trusted. But there's a soft underbelly of somewhere between 11-16% of people who are like, yeah, maybe we should throw them in jail. You know, maybe this is such a big problem, we should throw them in jail. And Matt, that is a technique that's used by authoritarian regimes.
So is this more signaling than anything else? Is this like, we're not going to burn the witches, but we're going to remove the spell books from the library to signal that we're doing something about the witches?
So any smart politician identifies what is of interest to their base, and they generate activity around what the base enjoys. Okay, it's how you get more donations. It's how you get votes. It's how you get a broader network. So yes, to that extent, absolutely. This is a politicized and performative action on the part of certain players. And on top of it, we have people who have deeply held belief around these issues. And I have a lot of respect for that. I mean, the nice thing about the First Amendment is not just the right to read, it's the right to petition. It's the right to assemble. you know, those are co-equal with the right, the free speech rights and that the right to read is built on. I have a lot of respect for deeply held belief. And some of that deeply held belief is starting to stray into very, very religious activities. We're starting to see at libraries similar behaviors on the part of people who are concerned morally and perhaps narrowly morally, but they have deeply held belief. We're seeing people praying at the library over the books. We're seeing the person who kneels on the cement rather than on the grass is the one I'm very worried about.
So let me pause for a second, because this conversation has already been very interesting to me. Is one, we're not just talking about book bans. We're talking about criminalization of, you know, librarians and their activities, which I didn't realize this historically was always exempt under those various laws from prosecution or from any sort of being liable for criminal behavior. I didn't realize that. That's pretty interesting. You had mentioned about parents and a number of parents in surveys. Correct me if I'm wrong. There's a large number of parents, obviously, that are driving, for example, these book ban challenges, right? Which I guess we should make clear, right? Challenges of certain books doesn't necessarily mean inherently that they are banned, right? The subsequent right. step. I mean, there's a two-step process to this. So there has been an enormous increase in a number of parents who have challenged books. And I think if I'm correct, the statistic is something like 40% of all challenges have been brought by parents or some sort of parental right organization. Is it also correct to say that from the data that I've looked at or survey data, it's not actually a partisan issue in a sense that you would think, oh, it's extreme right conservative parent, Republican parents. But is it correct to say that actually there's a similar number of Democrats and Republicans or left and right on the political spectrum that are equally against book bans or challenges or criminalization of library activities? Is that correct?
So the statistics around who's been putting in the challenges, there is that 40% number. That 40% number comes from really excellent coverage in the Washington Post. Hannah Natson was the reporter there. She took a look at our data and Penn America's data. And discovered really that 40% of the book challenges in 2023 came from 11 people. The other 60% were from other actors. Some of them might be aligned with a parents' rights organization or some other anti-tax group, or they might have been independents. But in the 40% of book bans in 2023 coming from 11 people is a special interest project that is of unprecedented scale. I mean, somebody who studies networks and network effect here. I mean, if you're looking at a people powered movement, this is a several persons powered movement, you know, when you get right down to it. And I think it has a doctoral dissertation in it somewhere 15, 20 years from now, when there's some remove, you know. That said, the majority of parents on both sides of the political aisle, regular Republicans, regular Democrats, regular libertarians are not into, in reverse order, unconstitutional censorship, attacks on individuals, or the way that we burn down communities. You know, this has always been a 8 to 15% of the population issue. The 8% statistic was 2021. The 16% was by 2023. And so there is some growth in the normalcy of going after books, of proposing things like criminalization bills. The cadence leading up to the November 2024 election cannot be denied. You know, this is a politicized action around those spaces. But the majority of American parents, certainly, and the majority of Americans generally, are not in favor of utilizing censorship as a tool. Self-selection is an American ideal. People saying, you know what, don't tell me what to do with my kids. Don't tell me what to do with my own reading. Get out of my bookshelf. Get out of my bedroom. You know, like all those get out of my's are certainly American ideals. They're, this kind of overreach, this sort of censorious or moral policing is a component, though, of an American ideal that's not mainstream, but it's growing. I mean, we've seen it over the last 5, 6, 10 years. So what we're looking to do with these conversations is not just block and tackle on a particular challenge or ban. And I appreciate, Jeff, you bringing that up. There's a continuum, or there's a difference between those two things, but there's a slope that leads downward unless you can reverse course, you know, on a challenge. When the libertarians are interested in making sure that there's fewer government barriers and less unconstitutional activity, that should be a core issue for the party. You know, the Democrats are looking at ways to make sure that we are supporting everyone's right to have their story told. That's certainly about censorship. And then regular Republicans who are interested in making sure that society still exists, you know, who want to have civil society supported. I mean, the last thing you want to do is have somebody tell you you can't read the Bible.
Which we'll get into in a second, the interesting case in Utah.
In a building that has Dale Carnegie's name on it.
That's right.
Yeah, we'll get into, we'll talk about the Bible in a second. As John, I'm sure you're aware of the case in Utah, which I found was pretty interesting. But shouldn't we be optimistic to a certain extent? So it's not like a certain political ideology or party that's driving this. It's driven by, you know, a particular smaller groups of individuals. Most people on both sides agree that we shouldn't be criminalizing or banning or challenging books. There's also states, I think if I'm correct, it's California and Illinois that have actually passed laws banning book bans. But on the other hand, there are states that have made it easier, right? One state over, right? Indiana, I think, has actually passed some legislation. The Indiana General Assembly passed legislation that would make it easier to challenge books. So where do we lie, or what's your kind of overall assessment in being optimistic or pessimistic in this situation?
Well, like I said before, it's a 10th Amendment fight. You know, when you get right down to it, it might be about the First Amendment when it comes to freedom of speech, or the 14th Amendment when it comes to equal protection, you know, but really the 10th Amendment issues here. How does Illinois want to legislate itself differently than Indiana does? The movement right now is very starkly different between certain states. The opportunity this session, we've been supporting in Vermont and in Delaware, a framework around the Libraries for All Act. We wrote this in consultation with our State Library Association partners and the State Library and the Human Rights Commissions for those states and a few other stakeholder groups in order to have a new conversation about why do we bring the book in the library in the first place. The Libraries for All Act is designed to bring in state public accommodation protections for minorities and civil rights protections in public libraries to say, we're post-gay marriage in this society. We're post-interracial marriage. We're post-Bostock when it comes to trans identity, the workplace. The contemporary community standards should be clearly reflecting that kind of America. And yet we are still turning away books that are based on the color of the skin of the author or the characters. We're still turning away books at the door because there's a rainbow flag on the cover. I mean, we have to change the conversation about why do we bring books in the library in the first place.
So, you know, Catherine Oakley, who is a lawyer for Human Rights Campaign, I've seen some of her comments and interviews and such, and she raised that kind of very point that there's a certain degree of contradiction, especially if we think that the majority of books being banned now are related to LGBTQ issues. Right. And she raised an interesting point that there's an inherent contradiction there with respect to containing sexual references. So if non-traditional gender identities or homosexuality is supposed to be or liable to be banned, then the logic, by extension, that means that heterosexual or traditional gender identity roles should also be banned, right? I mean, if we're
Florida went, yeah.
So if it's an equitable approach, okay, sexual references, gender identity should not be included in materials in a library, fine. But that would then mean, you know, heterosexual traditional roles, which Catherine Oakley, I believe, said, all right, well, let's ban Romeo and Juliet, right? Mm-hmm. That should be banned as well. And I thought that was a very fascinating.
Yeah, it's a an argument. I mean, it certainly has a Socratic, you know.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
there's a Greek philosopher endgame there that says that we don't have identity anymore, rather than, you know, we have identity. I mean, if we're trying to provide comfort to the majority in the public sphere, society breaks down very quickly, because the majoritarian approach is always the most restrictive. Fundamentally, the majoritarian perspective is that anything that makes us uncomfortable means that the other is somehow or another criminal, you know, and that leads to persecution. That leads to genocide. I mean, my goodness. And I'm not trying to be Socratic myself here. There's a clear line between there's a clear straight line between efforts to criminalize ideas and identities and big problems in societies over history, you know? So we're not looking to have a zero sum game on this. The majority's comfort and interest in a book or a movie or an event or a program, that's nice. You know, we got plenty of good stuff for you. It's a protection for classes of minorities that require that protection in order to not be persecuted, not be discriminated against. And I'm talking religion. In some communities, Roman Catholics, evangelicals are not the majority, you know? I'm talking about the Pascal's wager of like, I'm a straight white dude in my early middle age, okay?
Quoting Pascal's wager, I'm allowed, and Socrates, okay.
Well, I mean, you have to, because these are the ideas of society, you know? But like the wager here, I mean, the Hobbesian, let me go Hobbes. Like, the Leviathan's going to get us if we're not careful. And so how do we keep it from getting us when we're not in power? You know, that's the rights-based environment here. It's not just First Amendment. It's not just the definition of whether harm is being caused or not. It's a representation issue. Why are we bringing the books in the library in the first place?
So one of the things that keeps coming back at me here is Emerson, to geek out with you, and the transcendentalists and the abolitionists, and the idea of those ideas percolating in these communities in New England and butting up against opposition in their own communities. And then, you know, in the Mason-Dixon line, mm-hmm. it feels kind of like that. I don't know where I'm going with that. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Well, I mean, what is National Library Week during a time of censorship? You know, I mean, like, there's the, you know, what is the 4th of July to a slave? I mean, like, there's, like, if you're not allowed to read, what does it mean to even try and celebrate something as basic as a core community anchor institution? You know, like, I think that the principles of self-determination, the principles of a reflection on democracy, those, all those noble good things that go back to your Emersons and your Thoreaus and such, are there. But I don't want to make it too noble, though, Matt. I mean, because most of what people use the library for personally is that they like to get their books. You know, they like to read. They read socially. They read for fun. They read for joy. They read for the human experience, you know? And I'm not the one to say your Agatha Christie novel is somehow or another less meritorious than, John Locke. I mean, it's the human potential for discovery and joy that the library not socializes, but in a progressive way equalizes.
So does this mean that libraries still matter? And does this mean that they matter more because of the community that they bring together and make feel safe because of your work, or because of the books they keep available?
So there's the famous T-shirt slogan about a good library has something to offend everybody. You know, that's not about comfort. That's not about safety. That's about challenge. And yet there are places within the library that are clean and well lighted, that are about that sort of safety and discovery and community building. There's the fact that the library is delivering materials now in different modes. We've got paper books, we got digital books, we got ebooks, we got audio books. Means that the print accessibility for folks with blind and low vision. I mean, my goodness, that all it does is say, if you want it, we can get it. And the reason you want it is meritorious in and of itself.
So I will bring us back down to ground a little bit more as we're quoting, you know, political philosophy here.
Well, I took you up on your podcast title. So
yeah. There you go.
So I really wanted to go back to that Utah case in the Bible, because I found it. I think it was so interesting, of a case study in and of itself. And so I guess in case listeners aren't aware, an anonymous parent in Utah submitted a formal complaint that the Christian Bible should be banned. And the state's review committee agreed, albeit temporarily, because I think about a month later, the Utah School Board or review committee had unanimously reversed its decision based on several appeals that were filed, which presumably were expected by all parties involved. And they agreed to make the Bible available in libraries and schools, stating that, and I think I got the quote here, quote, that the Bible has significant serious value for minors, which outweighs the violence or vulgar content it contains, end quote. But that seems to contain an inherent subjective challenge of who determines what is quote unquote significant value. And of course, what is quote unquote vulgar? Am I right?
So the fight happening right now around AP curriculum in Florida, for example, and certain other states, where books are being challenged in that AP curriculum, and coursework is being eliminated in that AP curriculum because it is difficult, because it is somehow or another vulgar or offensive. It might be offensive to our idea of history. It might be offensive to our idea of sexuality. The idea that kids are unable to handle something. I mean, kids, Sunday morning, Wednesday evening, you know, the Bible is accessed quite a bit by a lot of humans successfully. Of all ages and stages, successfully. I mean, I actually appreciate some reasonableness coming out of the Utah situation. The fact that it is a bit, you know, getting us back down to the ground level, reduced to the absurd, that somehow or another we have to put an asterisk on this particular holy book because it's holy, as opposed to all the other books that have something that might be difficult in them. You know, like this idea that, I mean, I wasn't happy when the book ban effort was made against the Bible. You know, it isn't necessary. We don't need to one-up each other. You know, the idea that this, that we're going to go after the Bible if you go after Toni Morrison. You know, we're going to go after the Bible if you go after, you know, Roald Dahl. I mean, like 1984, like this escalation of the fight is not something I was hoping would happen. Because the conversation around what is obscene, the conversation about what is harmful, is a very necessary one. You know, where what are the limits and the edges of free speech? Where do we run into places that are unconstitutional because they cause harm or violence? And that really is a very serious topic. The idea that we're going to escalate this in the game of one-upsmanship, and then that drives public policy. I'm not a huge fan of that.
I want to ask one more question. I've been really curious about the 10th Amendment discussion that's been underneath here, but that I think hasn't been brought to the surface. Are you worried that the idea that libraries fall under the 10th Amendment is under threat, and that you could get federal legislation that would, you know, would harm libraries, but harm access and overwhelm 10th Amendment protections at the state level?
There's always issues of preemption. You go far enough down, you know, the saying about there's turtles all the way down, you know, that there's preemption all the way down. And you know, like right now, FERPA at the federal level for K-12, the parents, the federal, you know, Parents Protection Act that goes back to the Nixon administration, FERPA, you know, drives a lot of these conversations around parent rights that are weaponized by the states, but the overarching protections for parents and for families to have access to school records, you know, access to the are there. Same thing, you know, is it federal overreach to call, you know, Title VI and Title IX of the 1972 Civil Rights Amendments for education overreach? I mean, if it wasn't for Title IX and Title VI, you know, access to the curriculum and even access to sports in K-12, you know, does it go the other way? Absolutely. Is it potentially federally going to go the, could it go the other way? Absolutely. And on a public library setting right now, there is federal preemption around the Children's Internet Protection Act, CIPA, which was instituted several years ago around filtering. Public libraries have to filter their internet access if they want to receive federal funds.
It's, as my 13-year-old son knows every other day.
Oh, yeah. Is that right? Okay, yeah. The K-12 and public libraries. So yeah, Matt, there's always that preemption kind of approach that's potentially there.
So I want to kind of just throw out the conventional pros and cons that we hear a lot and just have you respond to them.
Sure.
And then maybe have a little conversation about each of them. I only have three here. So the first argument for challenges and bans, et cetera, is that this is a parental rights issue, right? I mean, I think that's kind of like the traditional kind of explanation in support of these efforts. As a parent, right, I should have the right to decide what material my children are exposed to. How would you respond to that?
There's a difference between it sitting on a shelf in a place of public accommodation and a place that's a limited public forum, like a public library, or a place that supports the curriculum and standards, like a school library, or a place that supports academic freedom and discovery, like an academic library. There's a difference between it sitting there and passively being available and you making a choice to pick it up off that shelf. The idea that there has to be a nanny state governing, like, what are we going to do? I don't know if you've ever visited Trinity College in Dublin, for example, you know, with the big university, the big library there, it's always on the list of beautiful libraries. You look behind the circulation desk and there's a gated area for the books that were part of the Catholic ban in Ireland, you know, like, are we going to put them there so that nobody hazards being anywhere near them? Like, how in society do we live in a nanny state that's that concerned? So yeah, your own parenting, I'm not gonna, I mean, maybe I'll provocatively, if I'm a punk rocker like you, Jeff, buy some kid a banned book from a family, you know, like my neighbor family, my brother's family, you know, that kind of thing. But that's just being performative yourself. I'm not suggesting you're doing this, Jeff, you know, but what I'm saying is, like, there's a huge difference between saying my family goes this way, your family goes that way, and saying no family can have it if I don't like it.
Yeah. And as a parent myself, I would say, you know, you can keep your kid from going to the library, but this is a public space.
Yeah.
And if your kid goes to the library and chooses to pull something off a shelf, they choose to pull it off the shelf.
Yeah.
I mean, you're right, as a parent, doesn't extend to the nanny state. It doesn't extend to tagging the librarian and saying, hey, you're the babysitter.
No, I agree with you. Or we turn into like that town in Footloose, you know?
Exactly.
Well, let's drive this out of the library and into the schools.
The Gen X references here.
Let's drive this out of the library and into the schools. And we talk about curriculum. Certain books are being now read in schools. So it's not just simply a choice of a passive book sitting on the library shelf. Mm-hmm. Let me drive it now as a parent and presenting this argument. I don't want my students to be forced to read certain materials. So it's not no longer sitting passively on the shelf. How would you respond to that then?
So the public education conversation between local school boards, state boards of education, curriculum and standards committees, you know, the approach to having a curriculum and standards committee, setting those standards in finding materials that support the curriculum, and then the school library alongside that, both with curricular support materials as well as independent discovery. I don't know a single state off the top of my head, and I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that doesn't have opt-outs for parents. There's a standard and there's a curriculum, but parents have incredible discretion in the United States to opt their kids out. Alternative readings are assigned. Alternative events happen. I mean, I signed a permission slip for my 14-year-old the other day about high school sex ed. I remember the permission slip when he was going into grade school and elementary school sex ed. And I was like, oh, it's a little young, but, you know, still knowing that that's probably the right thing to do because I'm, you know, but like that opt out, again, the First Amendment isn't a, it isn't a coercion. You know, I mean, the First Amendment in America, Congress shall make no law that, you know, it's fundamentally about an opt out.
So it's pretty interesting.
It's great.
Yeah, it's really good. I like the fact that you highlighted the opt out provisions. And because I know the counter, one of the counter arguments is that also a single parent shouldn't dictate what other children read, not just simply their own. So that's why those opt outs are so important.
Well, I mean, the parents who want to run for school board, the parents who want to run for, you know, for state board or participate in that political process. I mean, it's a messy democracy that uses taxpayer money to fund education, and it has for hundreds or a hundred and however many years. And that discussion of what is right, meet, and just, you know, for every kid. I mean, gosh, I hope that there's some professionals involved and not just parents.
So to that point, Diane Ravitch, she was the former assistant secretary for education, I believe, under the Bush administration. She's also made a kind of parallel argument or counter argument, I guess, that single parents should not dictate educational materials because they're not experts. Right. And mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what discipline or field we're talking about, be it mathematics, the sciences, the arts, et cetera. It's curriculum committees. It's educators who are specialized in determining what is a good lesson plan mm-hmm. with the accompanying materials to educate students. Those are experts that should be dictating this.
Individual parent who is a flat earth aficionado. And I want to influence the development of the curriculum for the astronomy class. I mean, no offense to all the flat earthers who are your podcast listeners, but the science doesn't, the experts generally don't. It's, you know, like, why would we want to listen to a belief system rather than something empirical in a science class? There's analogies there for libraries, for educate, for English, for art, you know, the humanities.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant, again, going back kind of the logical extension of our arguments of what should be made. Like, you shouldn't have a single parent cannot dictate what's taught in a science class, same as what's taught in an English literature class. So,
but you know, the counter, though, the counter from the parents, right? And I don't agree with this, but the counter is they say, well, I'm the expert, my kid.
Of course they are.
Right.
Opt your kid out.
Yeah.
Homeschool them. I mean, like, have a good time.
But in the end, this is just another version of the culture wars, which they started in the 90s with Newt Gingrich, because this is saying our problem is we believe America is a Christian or some other nation, and the culture around us is represented in the libraries and the school curriculum doesn't represent that. And therefore, there's no such thing as passivity. It is an active affront to us, right? That's what they're saying. That's what they're pushing here. So they reject the premise of our counter arguments.
Yeah, a contract with America, you know, contracts compel behavior. And you can see it. I mean, the Gingrich approach of having a contract set up certain terms and conditions under which we could behave as America. And that's not the same as a constitutional approach.
Let me again, I'm trying to again pose these counter arguments to you. Mm-hmm. So let me just present this particular position that this is actually not driven by the right, which we've kind of already discussed and talked about. This is actually about the culture war and wokeism. And it's actually the left, right? The parents that are really driving this conversation. And, or we can highlight equal number of examples. So the Dr. Seuss book bans now because they contain racist imagery. How would you respond to that kind of dynamic of this is, you know, the culture war wokeism, however defined, because as Matt and I've always said, I've never seen a good definition of what is wokeism or what is woke. But how would you suggest, I mean, you know, respond to the fact that this is actually a left wing agenda of trying to, you know, remove these racist imagery from Dr. Seuss books, of all things?
Sure. So there's a recent survey done by a professor at Loyola Marymount. The survey was done from Loyola Marymount's library of university librarians, asking how many of you have been experiencing book ban requests, censorship requests, materials challenges. And the response pool was asked, are they coming from a traditional, from the right, you know, moral perspective, or from a left, wokeism perspective? And I got to be honest with you guys, it's about 50-50 on campus. We're talking about higher ed, okay? There is a feeling of harm that is coming from, like, is my identity under attack? And if are these books representing me in the wrong light? Are these books attacking my identity? That's a legitimate conversation about harm. The same way that is there a legitimate conversation? I mean, the one thing that we haven't said, and we should, you know, maybe rewind, you know, an hour or so and say it, is that sometimes the book is not a good book for that kid. You know, it's not a good book because it could cause harm. You know, I mean, we've got trigger warnings on things now, not just because of wokeism and like over concerns, but because we're finally becoming a little bit more aware of the fact that the world is a dangerous place. You know, the fact that there are legitimate concerns on all sides, not a both sidesism conversation, means that these processes where professionals are involved and people of good character, you know, people who are honest actors are involved in these conversations. That's part of America. That's part of this whole thing that we've been discussing. I don't think that we can do anything other than say that's true. There are people on both sides, all sides, who've got legitimate concerns with materials. Let's engage that conversation in a public forum.
That goes back to what we were saying earlier about, like, there's mm-hmm. not really a partisan divide here of one side or the other in terms of political party representation. And then that survey result, which we'll put in the show notes, I mean, you know, the fact that it's like a 50-50 in terms of, you know, left, right, in a kind of spectrum, that gives mm-hmm. us a sense of optimism, is that there might be a certain degree of common ground that we can have more serious or, I guess, sensible conversations about these issues.
I would sincerely hope so. The moral panic is not a great way to make good public policy. The identity politics is not a good way to make public policy.
So you had mentioned already about your own child and sex ed education. So one of the arguments, of course, is that children shouldn't be exposed to sex, violence, drugs, or any other quote unquote inappropriate topic. And in fact, I think in one of the, you know, kind of studies that, you know, parents or this position of the argument position uses to support itself is the American Academy, I guess, of Pediatrics, right, has a study that peer-reviewed legitimate study that shows that continued exposure to violence in the media or books or other mediums can potentially impact children, making them potentially act more aggressive or desensitizing them to violence. So how would you respond then to that argument that this is, you know, legitimate concern that our children, backed by potential science here, that children shouldn't be exposed to these issues?
Yeah, it's a question of where is the exposure happening? The team over at Common Sense Media, which is generally, I got to be honest with you, even on this podcast, I don't really dig Common Sense Media's approach generally. I'm much more of a hippie than they are. That being said, they did a hell of a survey. Very well-respected survey in January of 2023, where they asked a statistically significant sample of American youth, kids under 13 to 17. They asked a very important question, which is, where did you get your pornography? And 0% of them said the public library or the school library. 0%, okay? It wasn't an issue of statistical, like, normalization and stuff. There wasn't some chi-square that they had to work on. 0% said we got our porno at the school library or the public library. 20% of them said we got good information about health and well-being, identity, things I can't talk about with my parents, my minister, my counselor at the library. Okay, so it's a question of venue, Jeff, for me. There is violence in this world. It's horrific. There are victims every day of tragic, sexual violence, anger, people who are down channel from addiction, you know, like where is it happening is not, the question of where is it happening is where we should be applying solutions for those families, those kids, those humans. It's not happening, I would suggest, and the data shows it. It's not happening in the library. This is a canard.
It also seems to me that there's, you know, kind of talking about the venue, but children are going to be exposed in some point, if not relatively soon in their lives, but at some point in terms of sex, of violence, of homelessness, of drug use. I mean, just simply driving down the street with the homelessness population that has exploded across America, they are going to be exposed to these various challenging issues. And it seems to me that the counter argument is the exact opposite, that children should be exposed to these very issues in a educational setting where it is a safe environment to learn about these various, you know, inappropriate subjects, where they can be informed by educators in a very safe, controlled manner. And that's a great way to educate students. So it seems the opposite should be true, right?
I was just going to say, it sounds to me like the argument here, I think, that you're laying out is there are books, there's media that is in contention that exists in freely accessible public libraries for the public. But there may be cases where communities can have arguments about the potential harm of those books and whether or not they should lock them up in cages or remove them completely, right? And you're not making an argument that says that some communities might not make legitimately determined decisions to pull material. You're saying that should be done in a democratic way, right? Respectful of the 10th Amendment and the First Amendment.
So the standard around obscenity in the Miller test, you know, the constitutionally yeah. compliant test that the Supreme Court put into place in 1973 around determining what's obscene, includes the idea of contemporary community standards. And you talk to First Amendment scholars and they don't want to touch the word contemporary. You know, the courts have grappled over the years about what community means. I mean, there's been situations where a community was defined as everybody who's in the yellow pages and the white pages of a phone book. You know, community is defined as a census.
Let me just remind you that a phone book is where we used to keep our contacts when we didn't have an app. Okay, public service announcement over, right?
That's right. That's right. But that actually goes to what I was about to say, Matt, is that the community's got a lot bigger, you know, and a pluralistic and contemporary's gotten a lot more contemporary, you know, when it gets right down to it. The definitions about who can decide for the other in a pluralistic democracy, in our democratic republic, cannot be driven by special interests. And this goes not just, this isn't just a right to read issue around, this is a right to worship issue. You know, this is an identity issue about things that are sincere. And I would no more want a majoritarian approach to Sunday morning trumping Friday evening or Saturday, you know, like it's just, hopefully it's logically consistent. Hopefully it's got some moral, you know, fortitude to it as well, because you have to defend the stuff you don't like in a pluralistic society.
So libraries are a microcosm of that tension point in a democracy of majoritarianism, which we always end up with if we're in the Salem witch trials, or we're here and we are swerving back and forth.
Well, it's one of the reasons here
across our history.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's one of the reasons here at every library that we are focusing on the public accommodation and civil rights side of this conversation, as well as the limited public forum, First Amendment right to read stuff, because it's a whole cloth approach. And the society needs to have those conversations about statutory protections as well as societal goods and norms. It has to happen. And where else could it happen? Because it's not going to happen in a walled garden. It's not going to happen in a closed community.
One more question, and I'll let Jeff close it out. Do you think libraries are thriving today? Is this an indication that people are using them, that there's communities around them that, you know, that they're alive and well?
There's great numbers, there's great statistics that show that the library is well used, The library is well liked. The library is well respected. The fact that every generation rediscovers it is always newsworthy. You know, like, oh, you know, Gen whoever, you know, do the millennials ruin libraries? I haven't heard that one yet. You know, they've ruined everything else. So
my kids go, my 13-year-old, 11, 8-year-old, they hang out at the local public library.
Gen
That's
Z
where we find them all the time.
Absolutely. You know, the way it's utilized, the way it's put to work in society changes over time. But I mean, it goes back to, and by the way, it wasn't Dale Carnegie, it was Andrew Carnegie. You mentioned Dale Carnegie.
All right.
So Andrew Carnegie, it goes back to any time that you wanted to get together with an idea once in a while in community. And I'm happy to say it's still very well used as institutions around the country. I'm nervous that there's attacks that are landing, though, on the funding formula and the ability of librarians to do their jobs. That's what's keeping me up at night. But what gets me up in the morning is the fact that when those doors open every day, there's a line.
Yeah, and I'm always amazed.
The cockles of my heart.
Mm-hmm. I'm always amazed by how libraries continue to innovate and stay, we don't use the term contemporary, right? I mean, you know, my local library has, you know, coffee shops now inside of it. Mm-hmm. A lot of libraries use their space for forums and community engagements or small business associations. Yep. And so I think it's a very optimistic sign that, you know, libraries continue to adapt in the contemporary world.
Mm-hmm. Well, the original Carnegie Library, these not a lot of them were built, unfortunately, but it was a library and a gymnasium. Okay. So like you would have, it was like having the YMCA.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. It was like having the rec center attached to the library, you know, because
that explains the way they look. They do look like gyms. Huh?
Yeah. Some of them do. Absolutely. Yeah. And if you go to the original Carnegie Library in Carnegie, Pennsylvania, it's a gymnasium. There's a theater attached to it. Okay, like this was like a civic engine. I mean, it was the bookstore, record store, coffee shop of their generation.
I want to do the very last presentation of the pro and against book bans and challenges, et cetera. And this one, I think, is on the opposite end of the spectrum, meaning those who are opposed to book bans.
Mm-hmm.
And the argument from their perspective is this is all about censorship, right? Are book bans and criminalization of library activities, is that a form of censorship?
Book bans and criminalization. So criminalization activity is a performative but weaponized approach to censorship. I mean, if you want a blanket environment where you can't access something, it's either totalitarian regimes or there's a threat of criminal prosecution, you know? So yeah, the folks who are looking to support an environment where books are available, where access is free and low barrier or unfettered, they come from a couple of different perspectives. There are the First Amendment fans that are out there. You know, the First Amendment fans who are like, every flower needs some water, you know? We've got people who are involved in anti-censorship, anti-discrimination campaigns because they know that if voices are silenced, humans are hurt, you know? And we've got the majority of the folks who are opposing book bans are neither First Amendment nor 14th Amendment fans. They're actually 10th Amendment fans, if I can come back around. They're 10th Amendment fans because they're like, well, can we just not screw up society anymore? Why are we doing this? You know, like, what kind of town do we want to live in? Do we want to live in a town where that guy gets to tell me what to do? Even though he and I went to high school together, I mean, I know what he's like. You know, like the 10th Amendment aspects of this, most people are civil society on these topics. The First Amendment fans will come out. The people who are defending other humans will come out. But we're really needing to have a new dialogue in this country around what it means to just be neighborly, you know, just be like live and let living. So there's, I mean, what kind of town, what kind of state, what kind of nation do we want to have? Those rights are core, but the big issues about like how do we live together in our democratic republic are getting played out right now on both sides of this issue.
Is there anything that we're missing in this discussion or debate that we're not covering that you think more Americans should be aware of on either side of the political spectrum or the divide of bans and criminalization?
You know, libraries in general, public libraries in particular, but academic and school libraries too, rely on something that's very important, which is that they are able to lend. You know, there's a public policy issue here around how do we tax ourselves to fund the common good, but libraries fundamentally are able to lend. It is a very capitalistic thing, even though it kind of looks socialistic. Libraries buy materials when they can, because these ebook licenses are a mess. But, you know, they can buy materials and do something that's very capitalistic. They can lend, you know. Capitalistic is also they can resell it. You know, you get your book sales that go on. You know, capitalistic would be they could lease it potentially, though nobody does that, you know. So whatever you can do with a car. You know, my automobile, I can, you know, if I'm Hertz, I'm leasing it to you. Like that aspect of libraries and that ability to lend is being impinged most clearly by book bans. You know, it's not that there is something magical about libraries. There's something fundamental. I mean, our economy, our educational system, all rely on those kinds of protections, and censorship fundamentally impinges the not just the individual's right to read, but the society's ability to participate in that social economy. And I think that's underappreciated in these fights. Folks who have nothing to do with the rights provisions here, who look at the First Amendment as being like, get out of my, you know, like just, it's so noisy. Why are you yelling at me? Just the basics of society here are really being questioned in a fight around bans and censorship.
Well, John, I want to sincerely thank you for joining us on In Politic. Your work with Every Librarian Advocacy is absolutely essential in ensuring the free flow of ideas and knowledge contained within books. So your work really strikes at the heart of a larger, obviously political and clearly social debate unfolding in the United States today. So thank you for your time.
Jeff, Matt, I really appreciate being able to be on the show. That you're very kind to me for this line of inquiry. Thanks a lot.
John, it was so great, and I'm going to go out and get a t-shirt made that says, it's the 10th Amendment, stupid.